From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The gunmen who terrorized Mumbai nearly 2 weeks ago now were well-armed, not just with weapons, but with communications technology and the know-how to use it. It was, as Emily Wax observed in the Washington Post, terrorism in the digital age, planned with Google Earth maps, navigated with GPS equipment, and coordinated with BlackBerry's voice-over internet protocol and a succession of cell phones. Once the attacks were underway, others rushed in to cover the story with their own BlackBerries and cell phones, along with the video cameras of several global news channels and dozens of Indian ones. Let's start there. India's local stations were criticized for reporting perhaps too well on the movements of government commandos, so much so that local authorities shut them down for 45 minutes early in the attacks. Arnab Goswami is the chief editor of India's largest national news station, Times Now. He says the public breathed in the coverage like air, and when it was cut, the response was
massive. Massive. I was inundated with phone calls. Every single phone was ringing. People were watching us so closely that if we were off for 5 seconds, they would react. Because cable and satellite television is largely the only form of receiving information at a time like this. Very few people in India in a live situation actually go to the internet to find out what's happening. So you actually cut off the main source of information. But I must appreciate the role of the government in Delhi, which the moment we brought it to their notice, they immediately acted, sent a message to the police, and made sure that we were up within 15 minutes of the official complaint going out.
But weren't you concerned that, in fact, the terrorists were monitoring those broadcasts?
I spoke live on the course of my coverage to several foreign nationals who were, in fact, inside the hotel. So when I asked them whether they were getting TV, they said no. There are now some reports that they had BlackBerries with them through which they access some of the Western media, especially the British media. But the fact is that there were briefings from the army, from the heads of the police forces. And besides that information, which was coming from official credible sources, the media was only reporting in terms of eyesight and earsight. Why people are sort of, you know, asking questions about the media is because they are not used to seeing this kind of urban warfare in India. Terrorism in India has always been the kind of phenomenon in which a bomb goes off suddenly. It's not captured on camera. You have never had a situation for a prolonged period of time. You've had a live televised encounter going on. But I don't think in those 3 days we really gave any information away.
But weren't you among the heads of several stations that told your anchors to stop reporting on the positions of commandos?
Yes, I personally did that. I anchored for 65 hours, and on several occasions, I did stop my reporters on air live from giving some information, which they felt was breaking news at that point of time, but which could have left us open to the charge of giving information away. And this is against a particular backdrop, which I'd like to share with you. India has had a largely, closed media with only state-run television for 40 years after its independence. That's 1947 to 87. The television media in its present form and private TV channels are only 10 years old. And the power of the television media and news channels is something that sometimes even scares the government. And we are going through a phase when, on the one hand, the government wants to put a content code on top of us, which would make every police inspector have some power over every news channel. We want to fight that situation. We are fighting for self-regulation. And it is very important that we don't give the opportunity for anyone in the government to accuse us of giving away these kind of details. That was uppermost in my mind when on several occasions I stopped my reporters from giving away such information.
And on Thursday, when I suppose the heads of dozens of television stations in Mumbai got together to discuss the situation, what was the main topic?
You must keep in mind that there has been tremendous criticism of politicians in India. There's a great frustration among people that their politicians have let them down and not acted on intelligence information. Perhaps the government's on the defensive. So the government's given out an advisory. Part of the advisory is seen as is taking away the role that editors need to have of deciding what news to carry and what not to carry. And for one part of the chat was how to deal with that. The second part was a free and independent exchange of views on what the learnings are from this entire issue. And the more complicated subjects that have come up in the process, such as should we take interviews with terrorists on television if they're available on the phone? How far should we go? I must share with you, the responsibility of the TV media was quite evident to me. This was just day before yesterday. There was a lot of explosives found at one of the main railway stations where the first shootout, in fact, took place. And just about a kilometer from there, there were thousands and thousands of people out in a very peaceful gathering at the Gateway of India. And that information was actually broadcast by a TV channel. And when I made a phone call to five or six other channel heads asking them to pull back that information about a bomb being found because it could just lead to a stampede, within seconds all the channels took back that information. What point I'm trying to make is that there's a very proactive attitude towards the responsibility of the media among news channels. What we are trying to do is ensure that this stays with us and that the government does not use a situation such as this to clamp us down.
There has been some suggestion that many Indian television stations now are whipping up a great deal of anger between Muslims and Hindus and also against Pakistan. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
I don't think so. I can understand some of the reports that could be coming to you could represent the more extreme views of the Indian media. But let me tell you, it is a very, very, very mature, balanced, serious coverage which is going on here. In fact, I personally host the most watched 9 p.m. show here in India. And I said it on the last three episodes. I've always ended by saying that warmongering is not going to get India anywhere. Because here in this country, if there is a war, it could just spiral out of control. So I think the responsibility is very much there, not just me, but with every single member, largely, of the Indian media.
And if there's one message you take from this whole horrible experience, what would it be?
We need to be more prepared, both in the media and in the government. Obviously, this caught all of us hugely by surprise. We didn't know what we were dealing with. What we need right now is an immediate coordination mechanism, information dissemination mechanism, so that there is no hype, there is no hysteria, there is no false information. God forbid should something like this happen again.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure talking to you.
Arnab Goswami is chief editor of Times Now, an English language news channel in India. Most of the Western media relied on the Indian news channels, of which there are dozens, for footage as the attacks unfolded. To Gaurav Mishra, an expert in social media, when the shooting started, outsiders were forced to rely on Twitter feeds, brief dispatches sent by text message to countless computers and cell phones. Mishra says the global power of Twitter was really put to the test in Mumbai.
For most Western audiences, the only real source of news for the first 6 hours or so was the Twitter feed from people in Mumbai staying close to the scene of the event or people who had friends close to the scene of the events. Many people outside Bombay and especially outside India were trying to use Twitter to make sense of what was happening in Bombay. And Twitter users in Bombay were trying to help out these people by sharing helpline numbers, also by offering to convey some information themselves.
So were these citizen journalists or were they really just disseminators of mainstream news information?
There were some who did journalism in the traditional sense. One person called Venu Kumar Ranganathan went out very early in the crisis and took 100-odd pictures on the crisis scene, uploaded them to Flickr, then tweeted about it. Some of us started posting links to his Flickr photo pool, and suddenly everybody was using those photos in their coverage. That was clearly citizen journalism in its best sense. What was happening on Twitter was not analysis, but yes, there were elements of breaking news on Twitter.
But there was a lot of confusion about the basic facts on television. Do you think that their reliance on some social sites like Twitter actually caused unsubstantiated rumors to get broadcast?
Yes, some of that happened, but even though thousands of people in India, or at least close to 1,000, they were twittering about the events, it very quickly became obvious who were the people who were doing it responsibly. And very quickly, people started sharing lists of Twitter users in India to follow, and they became the conduits through which information was flowing.
You've suggested a kind of code of ethics for the online community.
Actually, I saw very specific examples of people online using great restraint in posting stories about the crisis. For instance, Vinu, who posted some of the first photos of the crisis on Flickr, he had some pictures of the injured and the dead, and he asked us on his blog if he should post those pictures, and we said no, and he refrained from posting those pictures. Similarly, another photo blogger who was taking pictures of the site on the second day of the crisis specifically wrote on his blog that he had posted these pictures with more than 1 hour's time lag so that it doesn't give any sensitive information to the terrorists. So people were showing restraint. I think it's a personal choice mostly. There will be some chaos online. I don't think it's possible to implement a code of conduct.
There's been lots of criticism of the network coverage, giving the terrorists a tactical advantage by showing them too much, by making them into celebrities.
Yes, the television channels did cross a line between breaking news and broadcasting sensitive information which might have been useful to the terrorists. But we also need to remember that while some of the Indian television news channels have been around for close to a decade, most of them have been around for less than 5 years. Many people have argued that this was the first big test for the television channels. And as much as I hate to defend Indian news media on this, I would say that given all these constraints, they did a reasonably good job.
So in the wake of these attacks, are there narratives springing up on the new media versus the old media?
For me, the story is that many people, thousands of people, came together and tried to make sense of what was happening using a new service like Twitter. And new media and mainstream media complemented each other in covering this story. And increasingly, I see that traditional newspapers and television channels, news organizations of all sorts, will have in-house people who have high levels of familiarity with new media, who are good at curating news coming out of new media. So I see that as one of the lessons going forward.
Gaurav, thank you very much.
Thank you for speaking to me.
Gaurav Mishra is the Yahoo Fellow in International Values, Communications, Technology, and Global Internet at Georgetown University.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. You may have heard the tragic story of Megan Meyer, the victim of what has come to be called cyberbullying. Megan's adult neighbor, Lori Drew, along with her daughter and one of her employees, used a fake MySpace account to befriend and then reject Megan, 13 years old and struggling with depression. Megan then killed herself. When the story broke last fall, public outrage erupted at Lori Drew, a grown-up who had harassed a child online. The tragedy resulted in a landmark legal case, which culminated last week when Drew was found guilty on 3 misdemeanor counts of computer fraud for gaining unauthorized access to MySpace. Specifically, she was convicted of violating the site's Terms of Service Agreement, the online contract you must agree to before you can access MySpace and many other sites. While the jury acquitted Drew of the most serious charge and reduced felonies to misdemeanors, the verdict has been widely criticized by legal experts who argue that the prosecutors misapplied existing anti-hacking laws in this case. The verdict is on appeal and may be overturned, but in the meantime, we asked the Berkman Center's Christopher Segoyan to explain how this case might affect the way we use the Internet. Chris, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. Let's just make this clear from the outset. Lori Drew was not convicted of cyberbullying, was she?
No, that's correct. And the reason for that is that there is actually no cyberbullying statute on the books. What she was convicted of was essentially hacking.
Can you tell me how the prosecution argued that case?
To begin with, we should first mention that this incident happened in Missouri, and the U.S. attorney in Missouri declined to prosecute the case. And so because the bullying was happening through MySpace, which is a California company, a U.S. attorney in Central California decided to pick up the case and has been personally prosecuting it. Essentially, the prosecutor's theory is that when anyone violates the terms of service specified by a website, they are engaging in computer hacking.
Including every 17-year-old and younger who makes a Google search.
Right. So Google's terms of service specifically forbid anyone under the age of 18 from engaging in a web search, from sending an email, from uploading a photo to their Picasa website, MySpace's terms of service specifically state that you may not, as an end user, upload a photograph of another person that you have posted without that person's consent. What this means is that if you take a photo at your family reunion, you must go around the room and obtain every single person's permission to upload that photo to your MySpace page later that day. If you don't do it, you're a criminal. I also want to highlight the Match.com terms of service, which state that it's forbidden to create a profile if you're married or not separated from your partner. This means that essentially cheating spouses are engaged in computer hacking if they look for dates online.
And then there's the MySpace and Facebook prohibitions against uploading any sort of advertising and marketing material. That was in Madison Avenue into a tizzy because, you know, commercially based viral video, for example, could be posted, correct?
That's very true. So, you know, we think of things like the subservient chicken, Burger King's hugely popular viral video. And technically, it would be a violation of the terms of service and thus computer hacking to upload one of those YouTube videos or even link to them from your MySpace page.
So at the risk of sounding utterly absurd, I could start a website and make one of the terms of service that if you are a carbon-based organism, you are not eligible to use this service. You must leave immediately. Then anyone who logged on could be prosecuted for hacking.
That's exactly correct. And, you know, that seems silly, but that's actually already sort of happened. Aaron Kerr, who is a professor of law, a former DOJ prosecutor, and who is representing Lori Drew pro bono, has updated the terms of service of his website to prohibit anyone who's ever visited the state of Alaska or any federal employee from visiting or posting to his blog, as an example of how insane this new ruling is.
I'm curious, though, has anyone in all of human history ever read one of these things? I mean, like, ever?
Actually, yes. One person appears to read every terms of service document that she's presented, and that is the lead juror in the Lori Drew trial. She told Wired News this week, quote, "The thing that really bothered me was that Drew's attorney kept claiming that nobody reads the terms of service. I always read the terms of service. If you choose to be lazy and not go through that entire agreement or contract, then absolutely you should be held liable."
Okay. Christopher, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Have a good day.
Christopher Segoyan is a student fellow at Harvard University's Berkman Center for Internet and Society and blogs about privacy and security for CNET. So we know that one of the jurors in the Lori Drew case reads every terms of service agreement. But does anyone else? And if not, why not? James Grimmelman teaches law at the Institute for Information Law and Policy at the New York Law School. He says terms of service agreements exist because lawyers want to protect companies from any possibility that anyone could go after them for anything.
Could we get sued because we didn't warn people that there might be disturbing content here? Could we get sued because we kicked somebody off for being abusive? They don't rely on the fact that you actually know what terms of service are. They just need to be able to say that you said you agreed and you could have read them. Therefore, don't hold your failure to do so against us.
Okay, but it's still a legally binding contract, right?
The courts have been pretty clear that if they make you check a box to agree and give you a chance to read the terms, then that counts. If it's just a link at the bottom of the website, something you could have clicked on but may never have seen, that's still unsettled.
Okay, so I subscribe to iTunes, and in order to do that, I have to go through like 29 single-spaced pages of various disclaimers and click I accept. And now I have iTunes. But what else have I got? Have I got any kind of personal legal liability?
You've agreed to potentially some scary things. You've agreed to let them potentially sue you in California. You have agreed to hold them harmless if they cause your computer to emit smoke and blow up. And you've definitely agreed to pay for anything that you purchase on iTunes, even if it was your dog clicking the mouse.
And I guess if the precedent in the Lori Drew case holds up, I've also put myself in jeopardy of jail for hacking should I, say, share a 99-cent iTunes with my wife.
Exactly. One way of thinking about these is that the terms of service are essentially no shirt, no shoes, no service for online sites. And we've now taken an interpretation that would make being barefoot a crime.
Now, I have, over my lifetime, bought many automobiles and also had quite a number of mortgages. And I have sat there, turning page after page, initialing and ultimately signing away God knows what, without going over those documents. And I think that's probably fairly common. But it's also fairly common for people to read every word. Is there anyone who reads every word of the iTunes terms of service or anybody else's terms of service?
No. There's a great study out of Carnegie Mellon that looked at whether people read privacy policies, which are one component of these terms of service. And they found that if Americans read the privacy policies on all of the websites they visit, it would cost $365 billion a year in lost time. No one reads these things. It's just not sensible to do it.
You mentioned early on that the terms of service agreements are written by lawyers for the purposes of covering the corporate backside against any eventuality. But sometimes I suppose that would get in the way of appealing to potential users. Is there a countervailing force at corporations to make terms of service agreements briefer, simpler, and less onerous?
If the lawyers had their way, you couldn't use the website until you sent in a signed paper contract agreeing to all of the terms. And, of course, the developers and the marketers say, you cannot do that. No one would come here if you made them do that. The rough compromise that gets worked out on most sites is that you don't have to click agreeing to anything until some point when you would have gone through a complex process anyway. Maybe it's the point when you enter your credit card information when you're placing an order. Maybe it's the point in time when you create an account. Any time when they have to force you to go through a long screen anyway to supply information. At that point, who cares if we give the lawyers their say? There are really no forces at all, though, that are operating to make the terms of service shorter and easier to read.
I have to ask you, I don't know if there's any legal way to analyze this, but it all seems like so much kabuki or shadow puppetry or something, where companies pretend that users read this stuff and users pretend that they've read it and click, I accept, and law has taken place. am I crazy?
In one sense, you've just described the magic of the legal system. What makes these online contracts, these terms of service, so strange is that the little rituals people go through are so obviously artificial and so divorced from anything people would think about in their daily lives.
Well, James, thank you very much. There's a document you'll need to sign on the way out of the studio. It's a release. You can either sign it when you leave or you can simply say, I accept right now.
I accept.
James Grimmelman is an associate professor at the Institute for Information Law and Policy at New York Law School.
In his new book, The Public Domain, Enclosing the Commons of the Mind, Duke law professor James Boyle tells the strange story of the sealed crustless sandwich, or for the patent law enthusiasts, patent number 6004596. The sandwich consists of, quote, a lower bread portion, an upper bread portion, an upper filling, and a lower filling between the lower and upper bread portions, a center filling sealed between the upper and lower fillings, and a crimped edge along an outer perimeter of the bread portions for sealing the fillings there between. Not big news to anyone who's cut the crusts off of a PB&J in the kitchen. According to Boyle, the patented sandwich is just one in a long list of examples of how our patent, copyright, and intellectual property laws can be preposterous. In his book, Boyle argues that while it's become easier and easier to disseminate information and ideas, the law has made that harder and harder to do in so many cases. Boyle says that although the sandwich case sounds silly, it's not. The patent made it all the way to a courtroom, and eventually reason won the day.
The judge acerbically asked one of the lawyers, so is my wife violating patent law when she packs my lunch? The kind of moment when you know your case is going badly. A lot of people look at patents like this and they say, well, look, if they do get to court, as this one eventually did, I think they were called the Uncrustables, some court will have an attack of good sense to the head and strike it down. So it might seem like it's just a kind of legal funny farm time. But it's actually a symptom of something going quite profoundly wrong in the patent system. Because when the state starts handing out monopolies over certain forms of knowledge, of invention, that actually imposes a cost on all of us. So this silly patent is actually a symptom of a deeper disease.
Gene sequences, they've been patented. To paraphrase the old commercial, is it right to patent Mother Nature?
There's really two sets of issues here. Some people say, well, wait, the gene sequences are there, so all you're really doing is plagiarizing somebody else's work, as it were, so you shouldn't get a patent on it. And then there's a second set of concerns which go to the question of like, well, what effect will this have on science? You want to try and make sure that you don't block the roads of scientific progress. Are we taking the basic building blocks of knowledge away from scientists?
And you say that that intellectual property issues often are described in the media as, quote, arcane or abstruse or technical. In other words, really, really boring. Since you say that this is so much a problem of communicating stakes to ordinary people, what are the stakes that we're talking about here?
Well, I think the stakes are the fundamental control of our culture and science. And maybe the best example I could give is a story that I tell in the book of trying to explain the Library of Congress online catalog to my son. I'm browsing through this online catalog. My son, who was then about 8, comes up to me and says, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm looking for a book that was published in the 1930s. And he says, well, you know, why didn't you buy it? And I said, well, you can't buy it. It's no longer available. The publisher's out of business. The author's dead. And he goes, well, why don't you read it on screen? I said, well, I can't. And he says, no, you can, Dad. And he reaches over and he double clicks the title on the screen. And a child of the internet age, he expects the book to open. The book doesn't open. Instead, there's, you know, bibliographic details. And he goes, well, where do you click to get the book? And I said, well, David, you can't click to get the book. And he goes, why not? You just told me no one could sell it to you. The author's dead. The publisher's out of business. Why can't you click to get the book? That's a really good question.
And the answer is?
The answer is copyright law. Because we've retrospectively extended copyright, people who wrote books under the premise that they would get 56 years of copyright protection are now covered for life plus 70. That's just one example of the way in which our intellectual property policy hasn't considered the interests of society and has said, oh, let's create more rights and extend them, with no thought to the negative consequences of doing that. And what we're doing is neglecting the flip side, the public domain, the raw material for the future, what the next artist, the next writer, the next painter, the next software coder is going to build on. You can't make a house without bricks. You can't build culture or science without the public domain.
But James, surely the internet and all the piracy that it allows suggests that we need to strengthen intellectual property rights and not weaken them.
First of all, just think about this. Supposing you were somebody who had copyrighted content in a world where you had a potential audience of 1 million people, and basically there was no illicit copying at all. And I come along and I say, okay, Brooke, I have a deal for you. I have this thing called the internet. Suddenly you're going to be able to reach 1 billion people, 2 billion people. That's going to be your potential audience. I'm going to reduce your cost of reproduction of your material to zero. I'm going to reduce your costs of advertising dramatically, so suddenly you can reach this global audience for pennies. But the downside is that now there's going to be an illicit copying level of 10% or 20% or 50%. Which would you pick? The closed world with perfect control and 1 million people, or the open world with the possibility of reaching billions, but also trade-off. You lose control of your work. What the movie companies and the record companies want is all the advantages of the new technology and none of its disadvantages.
And you write that the explosion of information technologies has precipitated an intellectual land grab, and that we need something akin to an environmental movement to teach us both about the existence and the value of the public domain and how to preserve it. I mean, exactly how do you create that kind of movement?
The answer is that it's already beginning to happen. If you think about it, if we could transport ourselves back in time to 1950, let's say, and I were to appear beside you and hand you a copy of my book and say, quick, Brooke, violate copyright law, you wouldn't have been able to do it. What are you going to do? Get a mimeograph machine, read it aloud? Now, fast forwarding to 2008, if I say to you, spend a day when you don't create copies, where you don't digitally create things, it's almost impossible for us not to touch on intellectual property law. So the thing is, people, human beings, not corporations with printing presses or broadcasting towers, are becoming the subjects of intellectual property law. And a lot of times they look at what they find and they go, this doesn't make any sense to me. I'm perfectly willing to obey the law. But why is it that there are all these books sitting in the Library of Congress that are out of print? There's no way I can pay for them. And yet copyright law doesn't permit anyone to reproduce them. Why can't I get access to all these movies moldering in our nation's film libraries? Well, let's ask the copyright holder. Oh, we can't find the copyright holder. Oh, well, when could I get to see it? Oh, well, life plus 70 years or 95 years in the case of a work for hire. Oh, but they will have disintegrated by then. Too bad. That doesn't make sense to people. All it's doing is locking up our culture for nothing. And people look at that and they go, well, this needs a little common sense applied to it. And that's what I'm trying to provide in the book.
James, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
James Boyle is a law professor at Duke University. He's following his own advice with his new book, The Public Domain, Enclosing the Commons of the Mind, giving it away for free online at thepublicdomain.org under a Creative Commons license. We'll link to it too, but you can also buy it in bookstores, and you should. It's that good.
Coming up, 50 years of the John Birch Society.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Oh, we're meeting at the courthouse at 8 o'clock tonight. You just come in the door and take the first turn to the right. Be careful when you get there. We'd hate to be bereft, but we're taking down the names of everybody turning left. Oh, we're the John Birch Society.
50 years ago this week, the John Birch Society was founded by a wealthy candy manufacturer named Robert Welch. A staunch conservative and early contributor to William F. Buckley's National Review magazine, Welch remained scared long after the Red Scare of the 1950s subsided. Here he is in a video in 1965.
We have voluntarily joined together to combat more effectively the evil forces which now threaten our freedom, our lives, our country, and our civilization. So, of course, we collided with communism.
He was particularly obsessed with the idea that there really was an immediate, perilous communist threat to the United States.
Alan Lichtman is professor of history at American University. Lichtman says that Welch organized the Birchers in defense of America itself, which they believed was at grave risk.
Not from dupes, not from fellow travelers, not from liberals, but from card-carrying communists directed from Moscow.
And he called this society the John Birch Society. Who was John Birch?
John Birch was a Christian missionary in China who was killed by the communist Chinese. Robert Welch regarded him as a martyr. Indeed, the first victim, Welch said, of World War III, which he believed had begun at the end of World War II, and of course was the great confrontation between freedom and communism. Interestingly, though, another conservative, the commander in China, General Albert Wiedemeyer, wrote to Welch and said, you know, John Birch was actually killed by his own follies and is not an appropriate person for your society. But Welch, who didn't listen to anyone but himself, ignored what Wiedemeyer had to say.
It's also a bit awkward once you've announced your martyr to change martyrs midstream. Now, you have noted that in the first two or so years of its existence, the John Birch Society was operating pretty much under the radar, at least under the press's radar.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating. The John Birch Society is formed in late 1958, and it goes so unnoticed that there's virtually for 2 years not a single article written in the major newspapers about the John Birch Society. Then in 1961, the floodgates open and many hundreds of articles appear in the mainstream media. What happened? Several things. First, there was the leakage of an earlier work that Welch had written himself called The Politician. in which he called former President Eisenhower a conscious agent of the communist conspiracy. That spectacular charge propelled Welch and his society into prominence.
Not a dupe, not naive, but essentially on the payroll. That was the charge.
Indeed, a real live communist in effect. And even President Kennedy, in late 1961 at a fundraiser, gave a major speech calling the nation's attention to the peril posed by extremist organizations like the John Birch Society.
So by the time John F. Kennedy is raising his warning, the John Birch Society is marginal, but suddenly famously marginal. Everybody knew who the John Birch Society was.
So notorious that a 1964 poll found 65% name recognition for the John Birch Society. Extraordinary number. Also, that same poll revealed by a ratio of 12 to 1 that Americans would likely oppose a candidate supported by the John Birch Society. However, the John Birch Society had real influence, first of all, because it raised in 1964 about $1.7 million, big money for an organization at the time, and it used this money to build up local networks of supporters all over America. It hired paid organizers at the grassroots level and attracted many volunteer organizers.
I don't know if the Birch Society was famous or infamous, but it was synonymous, at least in the popular culture in the early to mid-60s, as kind of poster child for paranoia.
When I was feeling sad and kind of blue, I didn't know what I was gonna do. The communists were coming around, they were in the air, they were on the ground, they were all over. So I ran down most hurriedly and joined the John Birch Society. I got me a secret membership card, went back to my backyard, and started looking.
And that was the prevailing view, that this was a bunch of paranoid nuts who had this fantastic idea, not only that Eisenhower was a communist, but that American society, up to 40% of it, was riddled with card-carrying communists, that the civil rights movement was a communist plot against America, that aid to education was organized by the communists. And so, indeed, the prevailing view was that this was paranoia in the extreme, utterly unhinged from the reality of America in the early 1960s. Americans believed, of course, that there was a communist threat, but they mainly saw it coming from abroad.
Now, after the nutty charge by Robert Welch that Eisenhower had a communist pro-Moscow agenda, he was famously repudiated in the pages of the National Review by William F. Buckley, Jr.
First, of course, the Birch Society was thoroughly repudiated by the mainstream media. And then Buckley goes after originally Welch himself and then the entire John Birch Society. And Buckley's objective was to establish what he called a responsible right, the right as solidly conservative but not extremist. And that was extremely important in marginalizing the John Birch Society.
Now, the schism between mainstream conservatism and the Birch Society came into play in the 64 presidential race. Barry Goldwater ran against Lyndon Johnson, and he counted the John Birch Society as a vast part of his constituency.
On the one hand, and this was true of the entire conservative movement, they needed the grassroots energy of the John Birch Society. They needed the grassroots followers, but they could not openly embrace the John Birch Society. So Goldwater says, you know, we're not going to have any society members involved in our campaign. But of course, behind the scenes, John Birch leaders and members are very much involved in helping Barry Goldwater. They didn't help him all that much, of course. He suffered one of the worst landslide defeats in U.S. history, in part because people believed he was, to some extent, akin to the extremists in the John Birch Society. He could never quite shake that association, no matter what he said.
Now, the John Birch Society still seems obsessed with the idea of losing American sovereignty, if not to the Red Menace, to whom? The United Nations?
Absolutely. This has been one of the most fundamental themes of the John Birch Society. Really, throughout the history of conservatism, there has been great fear about the loss of American sovereignty to international organizations, be it the UN or be it the Bilderbergers, a secretive organization of international financiers. And it really doesn't matter what the specific enemy might be it communists or be it Islamic terrorists. In the view of the John Birch Society, this is all part of a bigger plot to create a one-world government that makes us slaves to a few small conspirators.
In 2008, is the Birch Society just an American version of European nationalism along Le Pen, Zhirinovsky, Schechel, Jörg Haider lines? Or is there something uniquely American about this worldview?
I think there is something uniquely American about this worldview, this idea of American exceptionalism. The civilization built by the American pioneers is the world's greatest civilization, and we've got to do everything possible to protect it from external enemies who want to destroy American civilization and submerge us into some kind of sinister international organization. That's as American as apple pie.
Alan, thank you so much.
My great pleasure.
Alan Lichtman is professor of history at American University and author of White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement. As we said, the John Birch Society is 50 years old this week and counting. The Society's current president is John McManus. I asked him if the John Birch Society is now, as some suggest, a mere shadow of the organization it was in the early 60s.
Not at all. Not at all. But the media has ignored us, and consequently a lot of people think that we went out of business. We continue to quietly undermine the establishment. When the media was blasting us, as they certainly did in the early 60s, calling us every nasty name you could possibly think of, the society was growing. And I guess some people discovered that that was the case, and so then the attitude got passed around, let's ignore them. And the ignoring began probably around 65, 66, and it has pretty much continued ever since.
50 years ago, the John Birch Society was on the front lines of the battle against international communism. That war is over. The Soviet Union collapsed. Our society managed to survive intact. How is the society relevant in 2008?
Well, you make a mistake in thinking that the John Birch Society was formed only to oppose communism. It was formed to oppose any form of totalitarianism and to promote the American system, constitutional limited government. So we were opposed always to communism, but also to fascism, socialism, Nazism, princes, potentates, dictators, kings, whatever.
As prominent as the John Birch Society became in the 60s, we've just finished talking to a historian who believes that it was at its heart an extremist movement. Is there any part of your history that you wish to disclaim?
Oh, no. Oh, no. When the society was founded in 1958, Robert Welch predicted that there would be wild inflation of the currency. He predicted huge deficits. He predicted a huge bureaucracy growing out of Washington, D.C., and all of those things have come to pass. We are for less government. We are for more responsibility among governments and individuals and even businesses. We believe that combination with God's help will lead to a better world. If that makes us extreme, then people should realize how far the country has departed from its roots.
At the risk of sounding argumentative, I just simply have to observe that those largest deficits occurred during the Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush administrations.
Well, that doesn't surprise us.
Yeah, tell me why that fits into your worldview.
First of all, the goal of what we consider to be a conspiracy is to build a world government. Now, you can't have a world government if you have a wealthy United States merging with countries that are third world. And so we believe that the plan all along has been to bring America down, have America finance other countries to bring them up so that we could be comfortably merged into a one-world government. The New World Order is what it has been called for many, many years.
What's the solution?
The solution is to get back to the Constitution. And if you go to the Constitution, you will find no authorization for federal aid, for federal involvement in housing, education, welfare, medicine, transportation, and all of the alphabet agencies that are regulating America and driving American businessmen out of business.
If 50 years into your history, a presidential candidate made an address to the John Birch Society, that would end his or her campaign instantaneously. Would it be better for you to be regarded enough as in the mainstream that you were not radioactive, or is it better for your continued life to remain on the fringe?
Well, you're asking us to be pragmatists rather than people who are standing for principle. We are not going to be pragmatists. We are going to continue to stand for principle. And we're finding that many more Americans want that and admire it. And it will filter down, so pretty soon candidates for office will be doing the same thing. There are candidates for office who call us and want to know if we can help them get elected. And we tell them, look, we don't back candidates. We don't nominate candidates. You go out and speak like a member of the Birch Society, the Birchers will find you.
John, thank you very much for joining me.
Well, fine. Any of your listeners interested, they can go to jbs.org on the internet, and you can find out all about our radioactivity.
John McManus is president of the John Birch Society.
Do you want Justice Warren to be your commissar? Do you want Mrs. Khrushchev in there with a DAR? You cannot trust your neighbors or even next of kin. If mommy is a commie, then you gotta turn her in.
This week, some confirmation of what many have suspected all along, namely that the media may be hazardous to your health. Researchers at the Yale University School of Medicine, the National Institutes of Health, and the California Pacific Medical Center reviewed 173 studies on media and health conducted over the past 3 decades. What they found was a powerful link between media exposure and childhood obesity, smoking, and sexual activity.
The report was released by the nonprofit group Common Sense Media. The intention, said lead researcher Dr. Ezekiel J. Emanuel of the National Institutes of Health, was to, quote, create a new sense of urgency about the media consumption of children. He said the findings called for a bold new agenda that needs to consider not just traditional media, but video games, the internet, and cell phones. Here to help contextualize the report is, you know what, Brooke? Why don't we just sing?
Uh-oh.
Like the beep, beep, beat of the tom-tom as the gossip girls drone on. Like the tick, tick, tock of the stately clock from dawn to dusk to dawn.
Like the drip, drip, drip of the raindrops, 1,000 channels pulsing through. As your life counts down to the moments lost to MySpace and YouTube too.
Night and day, you are at risk from every moronic show, website, and disc. Whether punked or heavy.com, you're standing beside a ticking time bomb that threatens you night and day.
Night and day, the stats say it's so. That perniciousness that follows wherever you go. Obesity, bad grades, and crime all increase with increase in media time. It's harming you night and day,
day and night. 200 studies say we long decades of besmirching researching, now the experts say.
The Centers for Disease Control say don't smoke, watch, or download much iTunes, rock and roll
day and night,
night and day.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. We also had help from Dina Prichep and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme, and this week we also enjoyed the piano stylings of John Dryden. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.